From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan. It's Thursday, March 27th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunath Chi, Shawa, Toksik Nusam, Salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. You can also join us live via the stream, via YouTube at ktoo.org/JPMLive or on KTOO's Facebook page. Hello. Today, we talk with Yumi Uramitsu ahead of their fireside chat this Friday, March 28th, entitled High Sign of the Sea. It's about early warning signals from seabirds about changes in the marine environment. We'll hear a story from KTO's Jamie Deep with the writer of an episode of Work It Out Wombats. We talk updates with the Juno Chamber of Commerce and CIGLA, plus Tongass Voices, perspectives from the homelands of the Occoquan and beyond. Those conversations coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
Hansen Gress, ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khanakaya ha anikak, gunish cheesh.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clan Edie have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher, and you can also join us for a behind-the-scenes look inside the studio. You can go to ktoo.org/JPMLive, where you will find us on YouTube, or just hop over to KTOO's Facebook page, and you will see us there. You can even drop a little comment in the chat if you want, which is more than welcome. Thank you for listening and or watching. The Fireside Lecture Series out at Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center wraps up this Friday night with High Sign of the Sea, about early warning signals from seabirds about changes in the marine environment. It's this Friday at 7 p.m. The presentation will be given by Yumi Uramitsu, who joins me now in studio. Gunath Chi, Sha Yigudi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you here, Yumi. Wasi Iti, how are you doing on this fine, beautiful, you told me it's sunny outside. I've been in the studio all day.
It is sunny. It's great out there. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's really a pleasure to have you here. Now, you are a research ecologist at the U.S. Geological Survey Alaska Science Center right here in Juneau, Alaska. Did I get all that right?
That's all perfect. Yep. I'm right here in Juneau.
Awesome. That's so good.
It's just a small bunch of us here, but yeah, we have a little satellite office here. Our main office is up in Anchorage.
Okay, I get you. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so before we get to this talk, I want to find out, like, how do you get involved in this particular work? Where did it start for you? Were you a kid? Were you always interested in sort of the marine life? Or how did this happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. I like to tell the story that when I was a kid, I always thought I wanted to be a marine biologist. And at the time, though, I thought that meant dolphin training, of course, which I really wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then I did my undergrad at UC Santa Cruz and started getting really excited about various things in the marine ecosystems. And when I finished my undergrad, I I came up and I started volunteering on the project that I now lead, which is the Seabird and Forage Fish Ecology Project at the USGS.
Wow. So it's really been a while that you've been working on this project, yeah?
It has been a while. I first came up in 1998.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay, we'll get into all that. But I want to go back to something you said about the dolphins. So I'm imagining, like, when you were a young child, were you thinking that you were going to be working with the dolphins at, like, Marine World? Or did you think you were going to be working with dolphins out in the... You weren't going to be, like, riding the dolphins at an attraction. You wanted to be, like, studying the dolphins in the ocean.
Or both. I think at the time I didn't really know.
Yeah.
I just knew I wanted to be a dolphin trainer. So, and weirdly, my very first job was working at a pet store.
Mm.
And so I also did some, when I was in high school, I lived near this amusement park that did have a dolphin, like, tank. And
yeah.
I got to go kind of work a little bit with the dolphins and raptors, and there was a bear there, and kind of figure out what that was all about. And I was always kind of drawn to it.
Okay. So this project that you've been working on here in Juneau since, you said 1998, 1999, somewhere in there?
Yep. Mm-hmm. 1998.
Right. Are we coming up on 20, boos, how many every years that is?
Yeah,
whatever,
like
that would
27,
be.
Yeah,
wow. That's so
almost 7 years.
Okay. So, and I want to start out because I don't know much about this. So I'm a perfect audience member for you.
Mm-hmm.
What classifies as a seabird?
Well, seabirds are, you know, part of this great group of what we call marine birds. And marine birds include, you know, waterfowl and ducks and these things that you see kind of feeding around the coast. But the seabirds are special because they're eating, they're the ones that we often see far offshore.
Mm.
Albatrosses are some.
Mm.
The main ones that I study are alcids. They're of the family Alcidae. And they are the fish eaters. So we have...
Alcids.
Yeah, alcids. Okay. So, like, you may have seen these little brown birds, marbled murrelets. They're very common here in the summer.
Mm.
In fact, this is the center of their distribution.
Oh, really?
The Southeast Alaska is really a special place for marbled murrelets. And they're an alcid.
Wow.
Common murres are another species that and one that I've focused on quite a lot in the last decade or so. Let's see, some other ones are tufted puffins. You may know they've got very colorful plumage, and those are some of the birds that I'm working on.
And those are found all here in Southeast, or are they found all around Alaska?
They're found all around Alaska. We start seeing, marbled murrelets are probably more southerly.
Okay.
We have another species of murrelet, which is one of my favorites, of course, is the Kittlitz's murrelet. That's a special bird that nests near glaciers here in Southeast.
Mm.
And so they're one that we've studied quite a lot. And we see that they will actually migrate from Southeast Alaska, which is the southern part of their range, all the way up into the Arctic, and
wow!
And so we've seen a lot of neat things with the murrelets and really any of the fish eating seabirds.
Now I know your talk is entitled "High Sign of the Sea," which is going to be about some signals that these seabirds are telling us about the marine environment, and I'm sure that is more prevalent than it ever has been in terms of what's going on in the environment. But I'm curious, just because you have this, you know, couple of decades, almost three decades worth of experience in this particular area, like, what have you seen from when you were first starting to work on this project versus where you are now? That's a huge question, I know.
Yeah. But. Well, there's been a lot of changes.
Yeah.
And the one species that I'm going to talk about a lot tomorrow is the common murre. And mm-hmm. and this is a species that was the focus of the project that I came up here to start working on. That you know, we've been monitoring some colonies in around Homer, so in the northern Gulf of Alaska, in Ketchumak Bay and the west side of Cook Inlet. We've kind of have a few species there. Back in the 90s, when we were working there, there was a very different ecosystem. The prey field, which is really the part that we have studied quite a lot, has changed. But you know, the birds are very robust. You know, their ability to adapt to changes in their food supply is pretty strong. They used to in the 90s produce 0.59 chicks per pair. That's kind of the number that we came up with. We go out every year and we estimate, you know, their productivity, so how many chicks they're able to produce. And back in the 90s, this is kind of our baseline for understanding how things were then. We saw that they were able to do that pretty reliably. And so at the time, we would have never thought that the common murre was really a good indicator species because they were so capable of handling changes in their environment. They have amazing adaptations to environmental change.
Mm-hmm.
They can fly very far. They can go, from their colonies hundreds of kilometers away to the edge of the shelf, the continental shelf break. They're capable of being quite flexible in their feeding. They may change what they feed on seasonally, and also even during the breeding season, they may feed on mainly small schooling fish. So small pelagic fish is a important thing for them. What they do require, though, is a lot of energy. So it takes a lot of energy for them to fly, to swim underwater to catch their prey. So one of the things that we noticed very, very abruptly was that around the winter of 2016, they started dying en masse. So people were finding thousands of dead birds washed up on the shorelines. And specifically, there was a guy, David Irons, was a retired Fish and Wildlife Service seabird biologist. He really knew what he was looking at. But and he was out with his family just after New Year's in Prince William Sound when he was in a boat and he was looking at the shore and it looked like some clumps of snow. And he went a little closer and noticed that there were just thousands of dead birds. This was the biggest bird die-off he had ever encountered, and it was a clear signal. And so he let everyone know. We heard about it in the newspapers. We heard about it. And within a few days, maybe a week, we had a team on the ground to do some beach surveys in that area. And we figured out that this was as widespread as it was, which was, you know, from Southern California to the Arctic.
Wow.
The entire west coast of the northern the northern U.S.
Yeah.
was really affected by this. And these birds had previously been, you know, really the trophically dominant species in the region. Common murres were called common because they used to be common.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So one of the things that we've noticed, you asked about changes. So we started going back to these colonies, which we hadn't been looking at them every year, but we did have some baseline information. So in 2016, which was the summer after the die-off, we went back to these colonies that we had started and started monitoring them again. And we found that their ability to reproduce had basically, they had years of complete failure, something we'd never seen before, something that's very unusual in this species. They've been experiencing since 2016 many years of complete failures. Not a single chick, not a single egg hatched. We've seen a new dynamic at these colonies, which is that they're much smaller than they used to be, and they're much less capable of being resilient to predators, and so the eagles now are scaring them all off the cliffs, and whenever they leave, the gulls come in and eat all of their eggs, and they're not able to actually make any chicks these days.
Wow. I'm talking to Yumi Aramitsu about her Mendenhall Glacier Fireside Lecture, which is tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, High Sign of the Sea. And two things I want to mention here or go back to. One, you mentioned, I'm just curious, what is the prey field? Is that the eagles and is it the prey field is the field of the prey, of the different ones, or what?
Great question. A prey field is basically, I mean, for the predators I'm talking about in this case is the common mer. So their okay. prey field is the forage fish in the around their colonies.
Okay, I see. And then now this discovery, or since 2016, and it sounds like it's prevalent, like you said, all up and down the Northwest coast. So are we figuring out why this is happening? And is that what you're talking about a little bit tomorrow?
Yeah. So we spent several years after the die-off kind of really doing that, is trying to sort out the scale, the magnitude, and the drivers of this massive seabird die-off. Now, seabirds, it's part of their life's history. They really do die off. Seabird wrecks can be quite common, but there's never been anyone like this ever before anywhere in that's been documented.
Like this record number of die off, you mean?
This record number of seabirds dying all at once.
And not reproducing, right?
It's associated with also a lack of reproduction.
Okay.
Also signs of they shifted their distribution. They also had, you know, signals that they were very skinny. So malnutrition has been kind of a chronic problem. Things that are just really unusual for this bird that tends to be much more robust in the face of change.
And so are we getting to the point where we know why?
Yeah, so it just so happened that I was working with, you know, a great team of folks. And we had been monitoring the forage fish. And we were doing that in Prince William Sound. And this is part of the Gulf Watch Alaska long-term monitoring program. Mm. This is actually a program that is funded by the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, and it was basically restoration funds to monitor the marine ecosystem, because when the Exxon Valdez oil spill happened, what was most clear was that we didn't have the information to know what the response of the ecosystem was.
Mm.
So this has been, we kind of were in the right place at the right time, because it turned out that Prince William Sound and the northern Gulf of Alaska appears to be the center of distribution for all the ecosystem effects from this major environmental perturbation, which I'll talk about more tomorrow, but as we call the blob.
The blob. Okay.
The blob. So this die-off was very much associated with this massive warm water blob that parked itself in the northern Gulf of Alaska, actually in the North Pacific, for over 2 years.
What? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, you've got me intrigued. I know we don't have time to go into it all, mm-hmm. but what a way to sort of set up this idea that, you know, the blob, like, I'm blown away, actually, by that, and in terms mm-hmm. of, like, that is a way you have figured out maybe what this is. And is there, will you be dealing tomorrow at your talk as well with what we need to do in the future to help this situation?
Well, I think an important thing that we need to do is be aware of it. So I think this is kind of the first.
Okay.
You know, in the scientific community, we're all very aware of the blob because it affected everybody's species.
Right.
Everybody who's been working on marine mammals, on fisheries, on oceanography, on any kind of creature that lives in the ocean, they know about this.
Wow.
But the people maybe don't know about it. So that's one of the reasons why I'm here today.
That's awesome. It is going to be a talk, High Sign of the Sea. You'll learn about early warning signals from seabirds, about changes in the marine environment. Yumi Aramitsu is a research ecologist out at the U.S. Geological Survey Alaska Science Center right here in Juneau, Alaska. It's happening at 7 o'clock tomorrow night, Friday, at the Mendenhall Visitor Glacier Center. It's the final fireside lecture, so if you haven't been out there yet, now is the time, and you'll get to learn about the blob and all the different things that are part of this. What a fascinating, it's just fascinating sort of science, and it feels almost like, to me, it almost feels like the blob and that thing. I'm sure somebody's maybe done a movie about it already, but it sounds like there's a little science fiction in there, but it's not. It's actually real and it's happening and it did happen. And so we need to learn about this. So, wow, Yumi, I really thank you for coming in and sharing with us today. How can we follow you or more of your research?
You can. So we have a great website that is available, and I'm not sure exactly what it is, but you could Google USGS seabirds and forage fish. It'll take you to a lot of the work that we've been doing on not just the MERS, but many things. And I will just say that, you know, one of the things that is a real focus of our work is to, we've been gathering data, so decades of data, and really trying to make it available to people.
Yeah.
And so there are data sets available there. We're also really we're working in Cook Inlet, and this is an area that it's really the only area in Alaska that has offshore oil and gas development. And we know from the Exxon Valdez oil spill that it's so important that we have this information up to date and ready to go so that people can be doing risk analyses and really make sure that when we are extracting resources, that we're doing it responsibly.
I will definitely put a link. I know a lot of times government websites end up very long and they have lots of slashes involved.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll make sure we put that on the link for the web post for this episode today. But like you said, it's your favorite search engine, you'll be able to find it as well. Yumi, thanks so much for coming and Gunnath Cheech for talking to us today. I'm really happy that you were here.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Okay. Up next, we have a Southeast story. Sydney Isaacs Holstein is a Craig-based Thlinkit and Haida artist raised in Klawak. Isaacs Holstein is a associate producer for the children's TV show Molly of Denali. She recently wrote an episode for another show, Work It Out Wombats. It features an Alaska Native character that draws on Thlinkit and Haida culture. Isaacs Holstein sat down with KTOO's Jamie Deep to talk about the episode and the importance of representation in children's media.
I want to talk about this episode of Work It Out Wombats that she wrote. Could you give a quick rundown of what you pitched, the process of producing this episode and watching it come together?
With Work It Out Wombats, the team really wanted me to pitch an idea that felt like Alaska. That felt like my culture. They wanted me to really embrace it, whatever it may be. And so I was thinking and thinking, what could I do? And I kept thinking of this Raven character because he plays such a significant role in all of our cultures for Tlingit, Haida, Tsimshian, and a lot more folks hold Raven in high regard. So I kind of pitched this character in a way, this elder character named Chinna, which is Haida for grandfather. And they really liked it. They were over the moon for this crazy, kooky, like elder, like with some mischief, you know, and jokes, and kind of reminds me of Tigger a little bit from Winnie the Pooh. And so from there, we were like, okay, we have this character. What is he going to do? And again, thinking of my culture, that Raven is this trickster, the mischief. He's smart and quick, and there's tons of wit everywhere. And so I thought riddles, and that kind of spurred on this whole thing. So it was like a really neat kind of balance of how tricky of a riddle is too tricky, and how is it too easy, and where's the balance there? We spent a lot of time together trying to figure out that balance. And then from there, once the story was solid, it was design time. And I had asked at the very beginning, like even before I started writing, if it would be okay if I were to see Chinna's design, because I feel very strongly to make sure that we're represented authentically and accurately. The Wombats has a very unique style. So it was like, how much of my culture and balance it with their world so that it doesn't pop out in a, you know, weird way, but it feels natural. And so his hat, his necklace, the shirt, his vest, all of that is very much based on the culture with references and working hand in hand. And then same with some of the props in there too. Near the end of the episode, that was all worked out together. And the dance movements and the drum beats, they worked with me on it to make sure it was accurate.
What's something that stood out to you or something that surprised you about working in children's media?
GBH Kids and the children's media department was really thoughtful, and I was astonished by how much they cared and how much they crafted all of our series, all of our episodes, and every single show was just very carefully done to make sure that kids were not only entertained, but they're also getting some education. And I don't think that exists everywhere.
What's particularly important about having a broad spectrum of representation in children's media and the projects that you worked on, whether that's Alaska Native representation, Tlingit and Haida representation, or just other forms of representation? Why is this important in children's media?
The early exposure that kids can get to different cultures and diversity and underrepresented voices, like the better off that they're going to be. They're going to grow up knowing this and just be more well-rounded individuals for it, with a broader experience and lens. And it's really important to have that because it's just a part of growth and life, and it's for everybody. The more voices that you have and different perspectives that come to play their part in how these shows are made, it just gives you a deeper and richer experience and a really great quality show. And I think it's really good for kids to absorb that because they can feel that through the screen and take in that information that they're hearing and that representation and grow up knowing, I know exactly who these folks are. I've learned about this. I've seen it on TV. And then it just continues. It just spreads. It's very infectious.
That was KTOO's Jamie Deep speaking with GBH producer Sydney Isaacs-Holstein about an episode of Work It Out Wombats she wrote, which features an Alaska Native character. Up next, we talk with Ben Brown, board chair from the Juneau Chamber of Commerce. This is Juneau Afternoon from KTOO. Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com. This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us on our live stream on YouTube and or Facebook. Just check out the KTOO pages on YouTube and or on Facebook. And you can even leave us a little comment like Shelley Delaney did. Thank you, Shelley Delaney, for coming in and saying that this is awesome because we are now live streaming. So I really appreciate that. I'm joined now by Ben Brown, board chair of the Juneau Chamber of Commerce. Gnathchish Ben Wasaiti, how are you today?
I'm good, Boston. Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So this is our monthly check-in with the Juneau Chamber of Commerce. You have many things to say. You have some notes and things. And so you're going to give us the rundown of what's been happening or what's coming up at the Chamber.
Well, we continue to do our weekly luncheon series. So just this afternoon over at TK McGuire's in the lounge room, we heard from Dr. Will Jemison, who's the relatively new chief executive officer at JAMI Health and Wellness, Inc. He gave a great presentation about the work JAMI continues to do in the community, and they are, to the day, celebrating 40 years this Saturday from when they were incorporated as a nonprofit back in 1985.
Yeah, they were on the show last week talking all about that. It was really cool.
So Will is a great guy, and my mom, Dr. Carolyn Brown, actually serves on the JAMI board, so she went out of her way to make sure I met him soon after he got to Juneau. We were talking actually about arts and wellness and some things the Alaska State Council on the Arts, of which I'm also chair, might be able to do to help steer them towards some resources to incorporate more art in the way they serve their clientele, because art and healing is an ever-expanding field. So Will is a real great example of how we're able to showcase important things happening in our community at our weekly chamber luncheons. So apropos of that, I just wanted people to know you don't have to be a chamber member to attend. If you go to JuneauChamber.com, you can sign up for the weekly luncheon. It's slightly less expensive if you are a chamber member, but you can also just pay to come for the program. You don't have to buy the lunch, although I will say they've been making really good food for us over at TK McGuire's. But next week, we're going to hear from Dr. Frank Hauser, superintendent of the Juneau School District. Obviously,
oh, wow.
Lots of community interest in what's going on as they kind of put things back together after their existential crisis last year. And then the following week, the 10th of April, is going to be Barb Miranda from the United States Forest Service.
Oh, yeah. Barb's a friend of the show, too. We love having Barb on. That's great.
Well, she's not been able to go out and talk a lot in public lately because of some things happening at the federal level, but she's been able to get approval from her higher ups. And obviously, there's a great deal of interest in what's happening with the Forest Service wider, but specifically out of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, what effects that may have on our visitor season this coming summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're really looking forward to having Barb speak. So again, next week, Frank Hauser, the following week, Barb Miranda. I won't be at either of those luncheons because I'm going to be up at Anchorage doing the Thanksgiving play. But at any rate, but there will be other chamber folks there. Corey Baxter is our president-elect from the International Union of Operating Engineers. I'm sure he will do a stellar job presiding over those luncheons. And I just would encourage the community to come and see what's going on there.
And one more time, though, and of course, everything we're talking about is available at JuneauChamber.com, but one more time, what day and time are those luncheons at?
It's every Thursday at noon.
Okay.
And our new regular location is the lounge room, aka the bar, at TK McGuire's in the Ramada Inn, formerly the Prospector Hotel.
Right. Excellent.
Yep.
Okay,
and
cool.
You can get registered online, and then we would love to have members of the community there. Sometimes the media come and cover the presentations, but sometimes they don't. But it's always best to be there in person. Today, Dr. Jemison answered a bunch of questions from the crowd who really seemed genuinely interested in learning more about what JAMI does in the community. So,
cool.
So other stuff coming up for the chamber. We will continue to have weekly luncheons after the 10th of next month, and we're in the process of getting those scheduled with speakers. But we have an event coming up called Spirits of Alaska, and that's something we've done for a couple of years up at the Gold Belt Tram. And we have representatives of various distilleries around the state, here in Juneau, elsewhere in Southeast, but also from up north, who come and they our guests are able to taste and sample their various gins and vodkas and other distilled spirits. There are heavy hors d'oeuvres to make sure that people are eating while they're sipping and tasting.
Sure.
But that's a great event as well. Those tickets should be available in the next week or so at the Juneau Chamber website. You know, we do spend a fair amount of time as a chamber, as a volunteer board of directors, making sure we have the resources to support the business community. And so this is a kind of a perfect example of a way to have fun, but also support the chamber's important work in the community.
Cool. That's excellent. Yeah, that's really fun.
Now, we've also been that important work really does include a lot of monitoring of what's going on in the government. at the federal and state levels, but very much so here at the local level. So we're constantly making sure that our members are apprised of what the assembly is looking at, what the committee of the whole is looking at, what the lands committee is looking at, because there's so many important decisions our local elected government officials make that have really immediate impacts on people's lives. I think the flood mitigation is a really prime example of that. The HESCO barriers have started being installed. Mm-hmm. And not everyone who has a HESCO barrier being installed is happy about that, but that went through a lengthy public process, and there was a lot of public comment, and people did have the opportunity to voice their concerns to the assembly before the decision was made to go forward with this plan. But what I can tell you is we've learned from the chamber perspective, we're not the experts. We're not flood mitigation experts. We're not the Army Corps of Engineers. We want to make sure that the resources are there for the experts to do their work so that they can work with us as a local community to come up with the best short, mid, and long-term solution and prevention efforts. But one thing we have been able to do is advocate with our congressional delegation. So again, kind of switching hats, I was back doing some arts advocacy in D.C. in January and then again at the beginning of this month. But I was able to meet with Congressman Begich, Senator Sullivan, Senator Murkowski both times. And in addition to thanking them for supporting the National Endowment for the Arts, I also had a brief conversation with them or their staffs about what they're trying to do to make sure, especially in these somewhat chaotic times in our nation's capital, we're still going to receive meaningful support to help us as a community deal with the Mendenhall Glacier Jokelhaupt crisis, which we're going to be looking at for the next foreseeable future.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, KTOO just hired a new climate and environment reporter, Alex Solomon, and you can continue to follow her stories and her reporting, where she'll be reporting on everything going on with decisions about the flood barriers and also talking with people in the community about that as well. So I would recommend people go to kto.org to find the fair and balanced reporting on those issues.
Absolutely. I think it's wonderful that you brought someone on with that specific remit, because I mean, so much news, so much change in the world is related to our changing climate. So I think it's just very honest and straightforward to allocate the resources with that title, with that name. And I look forward to hearing that quality reporting, which I'm sure that it will be.
Yeah, absolutely. She's really great.
Well, some other things that we've been looking on are, of course, the city budget process. I believe on the 5th of April, so coming up next week, they're going to be working. They have a day-long budget retreat, and they're going to be looking at the size of the fund reserves. I know we've had concern from some of our members that there's a little bit too much money being held in the bank, and maybe some of that should go towards property tax relief. I know many people's property tax assessments went up this year, so I will tell you personally, mine certainly did. And, you know, that's great if you have the resources to pay for it, but it puts a lot of people and businesses as well sometimes in a difficult situation. So we just want to make sure that Juneau residents are communicating with their elected officials so that they know what the effects of these increased assessments on the properties are. And certainly if they want to appeal it, and I can also say from personal experience, I have successfully appealed an increased assessment in the past, not 100%, but there are steps you need to do and there's deadlines. So those are things that we want to make sure the chamber members and the wider community are aware of, because those chances for interaction are time limited. And if you don't take advantage of them, then you may miss your opportunity to do that.
Right.
Another big priority for the chamber is, of course, the North Douglas Crossing. You know, we really see that as long overdue. And so Craig Gall, our executive director, who was doing just government affairs for a while before he stepped back in on an interim basis as executive director, has been monitoring the Pell study process and the McDowell Group's consultative process with the community about the different possible locations for a North Douglas Crossing. And there's been a lot of back and forth, you know, about the Mendenhall State wetland refuge space and other possible alternatives. So I just want people to know that the chamber is continuing to support that. Again, we are not the experts on where that bridge could, should, or will go, but we want to make sure that people are chiming in and talking about that, because we see access to North Douglas as really important for the future economic health of the community, but also as a necessary improvement in terms of getting from point A to point B. And right now we have had a near miss with the bridge a couple of years ago, and obviously it would be quite catastrophic if that bridge were not in functioning, usable condition and people couldn't get to and from Douglas.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's a whole host of issues, and I'm really glad that we've had Craig's years of expertise as a community member to monitor the government affairs element of things. But, you know, similarly, I mean, KTOO is an important part of that with the coverage regularly of the assembly meetings so that people don't have to go down to City Hall to know what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I let the reporters do all that wonderful work. And I look forward to all their reporting on these issues in terms of city budget. I'm sure they'll be covering that next week as well.
Absolutely. So this is our community, and so we all have a vested stake in making sure that it's a healthy and happy place to live, and the business community is a really important part of that. So that's what we continue to plan to do at the Chamber, and we'd love it if folks wanted to come join us for our weekly luncheons, our special events. If you're a small business owner and you'd like to join, certainly reach out to Craig or one of us on the board. We'd be happy to give you more information about that. And I want to thank KTOO, also a Chamber member, for giving us this weekly opportunity to update the community.
Well, monthly opportunity.
Did I say weekly?
You did say weekly.
Oh, no, I don't have time for weekly, Boston, and neither do you. You have too many other guests. It is a monthly opportunity. That was a Freudian slip.
Yeah,
of the worst
order. It's all good. Although it's nice to see you whenever I do get to see you. So thank you, Ben, from the Juneau Chamber of Commerce for coming in and catching us up on the Juneau Chamber of Commerce. I really appreciate being here. Gunnel Sheesh.
Thank you, Boston. Gunnel Sheesh.
Okay, up next, it is now Tongass Voices, Perspectives from the Homelands of the Occoquan and Beyond. Researching and sharing true crime stories from Southeast Alaska's history, Betsy Longenbaugh and Ed Schoenfeld host walking tours and talks, and Longenbaugh has turned the research into two books with another in progress. Her first work of fiction, Death in the Underworld, is based on a crime committed in Douglas in 1916, and they have a couple of upcoming presentations called Death with Dessert in April and May.
Our daughter, when we talked about Alaska's first serial killer, made a cheesecake with a cereal crust. So she's very deliberate about choosing the desserts and tailoring them to our presentation.
We had a story about dismemberment and a dismemberment, and she created a dismembered lemon meringue pie.
I'm Betsy Longenbaugh.
I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
Well, both of us are retired. We've been retired now for somewhere between 6 and 7 years. And our passion after we retired, very unexpectedly, became looking into historic murders in not just Juneau, but some of the other communities in Southeast Alaska.
And we call our effort True Crime Alaska, because everybody needs to be branded, right? And we research historic true crime. And it's not just to do blood and guts, you know, like so much of the true crime reporting is these days. But we really like to talk about what's going on in the community. And it really gives you a window into a community at a different point of time. I mean, Juneau in 1904 or, you know, Tenneke in the 1930s.
Yeah. And 1906, to be precise.
Okay. And beyond that, it's also just it gives us a chance to talk about not only the particular cases, but how the justice system worked, how the community responded to times of crisis, which in a small town, a murder generally is a crisis, and also to examine how the judicial system, the police, et cetera, responded to crimes against women and people of color, because obviously there was a lot of discrimination in those days.
But also how the media covered it. I mean, one of the things that have been interesting and frustrating is when we do our research, we know that there are Alaska Native women and men being killed. There's very little coverage about them in the newspapers. There might be an account that it happened, but often it's not much more than a name or two and maybe a charge. Finding those little bits and pieces, and sometimes big bits and pieces, is really the fun part. Again, it's the puzzle, right? Mm-hmm. It's figuring out.
And sometimes we just have a feeling that there's something missing that maybe we can find if we dig deeper. And it's the same as when you're reporting. You think you have the story, but you've done enough of this to think there's something else going on here we should know about.
We've been very clear about drawing the line at statehood, because when we initially did this work, not the writing but the walking tours, we included some cases that Ed had covered as a reporter and that I was familiar with. And it became too traumatic, not just for us, but for the people who were hearing the stories. I remember a walking tour where we were talking about a contemporary murder. It was 25, 30 years ago. But one of the people on the tour had taught the defendant in grade school. Mm-hmm. And another tour, we'd had somebody who'd served on the jury. And I'm from a little town. You know, I'm from Sitka, and I know how these things haunt communities. They really haunt communities. And we didn't want to be participating in that haunting. We wanted to be able to talk about stories where, as I like to put it, everybody would be dead anyway. Because it takes away that immediacy and the trauma. And I think the trauma and sadness of the murder, which are always just really heartbreaking, is balanced by telling more about their story. And Ed likes to think of it as bringing names to the fore that have been long forgotten. The first book is Forgotten Murders, and it's not just forgotten murders. In my mind, it's forgotten victims.
That was Betsy Longenbaum and Schoenfeld on their true crime research. You can find out about their talks and books at truecrimealaska.com. Up next, Siegla's here with some updates on events and happenings for the rest of this month and beyond. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
For KTOO, I'm Mike Lane, taking a look back at this day in history. On this day in 1964, many still remember, at 5:36 p.m., the Good Friday earthquake rocked South Central Alaska. The quake released approximately twice the energy of the 1906 San Francisco quake, and it killed 115 people in Alaska. That's a look back at this day in 1964. You're listening to KTOO.
And that's Mike Lane. You can join Mike Lane for Morning Edition every morning, Monday through Friday, right here on KTOO. Right now, you are listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm Boston Christopher, and Summer Christensen is here from Siegla to help us learn about some events that are happening. We have one left in March that's happening, and then a bunch in April, and we're going to go over all of that right now. Gunath Chi, Shaigudi, thank you so much. Summer, nice to see you again. Wasiiti, how are you?
Good. Gunath Chi for having me. I'm excited to be here again. It seems
yes.
like I'm regularly on the radio now for something.
We love it. And on the live stream, which you can join us on our KTOO YouTube and Facebook pages.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have one more event for March. It's on Monday, which some people might have as a holiday. And it's also the International Transgender Day of Visibility. It's going to be from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Juno Birth Center, which kind of sounds like a weird spot to have it. But there's actually a lot of businesses in there, and they have a really large room that we've rented out that we're going to have lots of activities and food and drinks. And we're having it from 11 to 5, so people can just drop in for a little bit and then leave. Yeah, it's going to
be
good.
Okay, and that's at the Juno Birth Center on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, excellent. And of course, you can find all the information for these events on the website, right?
That one should still be on the website. We still need to update the website for April, but all of these events I just posted on our Instagram.
Instagram and or on Facebook as well, you probably have. But Instagram's good to know about as well. And what is the Insta?
I believe it is at the Siegla, that the underscore Siegla.
The underscore Siegla, okay.
Yeah.
S-E-A-G-L-A.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, great. Okay, and then look at this calendar for April. This is amazing. There is so much going on, and we're going to talk about all of these events as much as we can in the time that we have. So let's get going. Wow.
Yeah, I'm super excited. We have a bunch of events that we've never done before. So Saturday the 5th, we have Queer Climbing. It'll be at the Rock Dump from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. And you can come. It's totally free. But we will have like a thing asking for donations, because a lot of these events we put on, while they're free, they do cost us to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the money that you donate just goes back into putting on more events.
Mm-hmm.
But it includes all the gear you need to climb. The people who work at the rock dump will be there to help you learn how to belay if you don't know how. And it should be a really good time.
See, I don't even know what belay is, so I would be definitely asking for help.
Yeah, and that's why they're there. And then the next day on Sunday, one of our board members is going to lead a hike. I believe it's called the Tolk Rock Trail, and it's over by West Glacier. So if you just head to the West Glacier parking lot, it'll be there, and it'll be at 11 a.m.
Okay, and that's going to be like a lead talk and walk kind of thing?
I'm not sure about the talk part.
Okay, but a lead walk,
yeah,
for sure. Okay.
And it's just an easy walk through the woods, so
I definitely see
a family-friendly one.
Okay, cool.
I realized I did not put the date for Pride planning. I believe it's on the next Tuesday. So maybe the second week of April, we have more Pride planning, but we'll post about that online. That's from 6 to 8 p.m. at the downtown library, and that's where people from the community can come and meet with us and help us plan for all of our Pride events in June.
And you're kind of doing those monthly now, too, right? The,
mm-hmm.
the Pride planning?
Yeah. So okay. that happens every month until Pride.
Okay.
And I think last month was really successful. We had a lot of people show up and mm-hmm. give a bunch of great ideas. And we went over it in our board meeting in March, and I could not believe the list of ideas that they had.
Wow.
So, yeah. We have
so we're going to incorporate them all, right?
I'm not sure. It was a lot.
It was a lot. Yeah. I can't get everything in. I'm sure
yeah.
that would be difficult. And that is on Tuesday the 8th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the downtown library.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. And then Sunday the 13th, so the last day of Folk Festival, if mm-hmm. you're tired of dancing, you can come down to the dog park at Cope Park, and we're going to have a dog park party from 10 to noon. And somebody asked, do I have to have a dog to be able to come? And the answer is no. You can just come to hang out with other queer people and pet dogs.
I do have a question for you, though, Summer.
Yeah.
How does one get tired of dancing?
I don't know.
okay. Just so we're on the same page there. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a kid who's never tired of dancing.
Of course.
So
yeah.
I don't know. I might have to drag her with me.
That's true. I love it.
Yeah. And
okay.
Then,
dog park party. I love it. On Sunday the 13th out at Cope Park from 10 to noon.
Yeah. That's one of our new events. So I'm excited to see if people show up.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm excited to see what happens.
Excellent.
So. Next, the week after, on Saturday 19th, April 19th, they have all the litter-free trash cleanup. And so
yes.
Sigla has like a strip of road, and we're going to meet at the Project Playground parking lot at 9 a.m. And just clean up some trash. I believe last year one of our board members brought donuts as like a, come on.
Little incentive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... that should
trash
be
in your body, but pick up the trash on the ground. I love it.
Yeah. And then another new event. We've done lots of crafting events, but now that it's getting nicer, towards the end of April on Sunday the 27th, we have Family Fun in the Park, and this will be at Capitol Park from 10 to 1. Show up anytime. And it's just for LGBTQIA-identified families or allies who want to just have their kids run around and play.
And that's on the last Sunday of the month on the 27th.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and then the last event in April, we've made it, Coffee Chat and Hangout at the Lodestone Library. This is our first time doing this as well, and it'll be from 2 to 4 p.m.
Yeah, and I think we talked about this last month, which was the first month of this sort of regular segment that we're going to do. But it seems like you're adding more events. And I thought you put it pretty well last month, and I'd love for you to talk about that again. Like, why are you doing so many more events?
Yeah, well, as people who read the news might know, there are quite a few attacks on especially transgender folks and LGBTQIA-identified families. And so it's really important that we spend time in community just being together. I mean, people are fighting the good fight, but I think it's also important that you spend time having joy and happiness be spread in your community rather than feeling down all the time. That way you don't feel totally alone in all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a chance to gather and be together and enjoy each other's company.
Yeah, and we mm-hmm. have definitely events for everyone. And I put this... so these posters will get put up around town, but I want to note that allies are welcome at all of these events. And I think I get a lot of people asking, like, is it okay that I come to these events? And we've talked about it as a board that we'll start marking which ones maybe we just only prefer queer people at, especially if it's like a more intimate gathering. But yes, please join us. Please show your support and help us feel less alone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that is the April calendar. And there's one more event we want to talk about, which is coming up. This is sort of a preview. We'll probably mention this when you're back on at the end of April. But this is just because you have a call for artists and organizations and stuff. And this is the Bloom Festival. Tell us a little bit about the Bloom Festival.
This is an idea that I had like 1 month ago, and then I just kind of went a bit wild with it. So this will be at the Jack. It'll be our first annual spring market. We're going to have LGBTQIA artists and musicians. We're also going to have supportive organizations and local businesses there. It's totally free to come. Obviously, we want you to spend money on the things that are there. But yeah, totally free to come. Juno Drag is also going to be there. There might be some performances. There'll be activities for kids. But we are still needing a few more artists. And we're also looking for food and drink vendors.
Okay.
So if you are one of those people and you want to reach out, you can go to our website and either email us. We have like a contact form. Or if you're on Instagram and you follow us, feel free to just DM us and we'll respond.
I see. Okay. And it's an opera. Do you need musicians too, or mostly just artists and organizations?
I think at this point we're pretty good on musicians, but feel free to contact us.
But reach out anyway. You never know.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to have some really – I'm excited. I've been posting little teasers on Instagram. Lily Hope's going to be there. She said that she might donate a pair of earrings if we do, like, a little giveaway. So that's pretty exciting.
That's pretty cool. Lily Hope earrings.
Yeah.
Love that.
And then we have lots of businesses are going to be there. I'm really excited. I felt very honored. Alaska Robotics, even though they're doing MiniCon the weekend before, they were like, I don't know if we can make it. We'll be really tired. And then they emailed back like a second later and they were like, yeah, we'll be there. So yeah, Alaska Robotics will be there.
Awesome.
Wolf Song Wellness is going to be there. And the owner has purchased lots of new things to sell. And I'm just really excited. It's really awesome to see so many people like coming in and supporting the community.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk more about the Bloom Festival. But for right now, what you want to know is that if you are an artist or you are an organization or local business who wants to be part of the Bloom Festival, reach out to Segla at their website, akseagla.org, or you can find them on Instagram as well,
@_Segla.
Yeah, @_Segla. And that is a wonderful event that will be happening at the end of May. But then, of course, you can go and find out. Soon the calendar will be updated on the website with all these events that Summer just told us about. There are a ton. There's things going on at least once or twice a week.
Yeah.
So that's great. Well, thank you, Summer, for coming in and telling us all about it today and for being here. I really appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
Ganesheesh. That will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. And you can also find us on live streams on KTOO's YouTube and Facebook pages or on our website at kto.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can catch past episodes, offer feedback or suggestions, or learn how to be a guest on the show. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support is provided for Juno Afternoon by Alaska Airlines Club 49, Hanson Gress, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gonna cheesh and have a joyous Juno evening.